to start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now?
What's your contribution going to be? What problems are you going to solve? What discoveries will you make?
I intend to broadcast from this ship 24 hours a day until the day I die. And then for a couple days after that.
No one's written your destiny for you. You make your own future.
I've always lived for news and weather. Happy to dive into them too. Especially the weather.
You're listening to Blunt Youth Radio, a youth-run public affairs talk show. And I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
And I'm Olivia Bradstreet, and tonight we'll be discussing Maine agriculture. It seems that today's society has lost connection with food, and this disconnect shows. Mark Lapping from Muskie School of Public Policy has done research showing that only about 10% to 14% of the food eaten by the average Mainer comes from Maine.
Tonight we'll be talking to people who are working to change this percentage. We have in studio with us Daoud Uma, president of the Center for African Heritage, and joining him is Kaylee Taylor, the youth supervisor for Tidewater Farms, and is attending the University of Maine at Orono. We will also be speaking with Crystal Gamet, who is the coordinator of food stamps for the Portland Farmers Market.
Remember, this is a call-in show. That's 780-4909. Please call in with any questions or comments. We'd especially love to hear from farmers and those of you actively involved in the local food movement.
And
soon we'll be speaking to...
Soon we'll be speaking to Jesse Doling, who's...
Who's on the phone now.
Or not. But anyways, we'll be speaking with her momentarily. She's from MOFCA, and she's the grassroots organizer for the Right to Know GMO, Genetically Modified Organisms, labeling campaign. So that's one thing that we'll be talking about. But since we have Daoud and Kaylee in studio, we're going to be talking to them. You're part of the Tidewater Farms project, which is with the Center for African Heritage. Who participates in this project?
Well, first I'd like to say thank you for having us on.
No, thank you for being here.
Is the mic on?
The people that actually participate in our program is, we normally try to get a very large selection of individuals. Mainly people that's possibly from refugee situations, asylum seekers, myself as a veteran, I'm a Gulf War vet, people that may have suffered from post-traumatic stress in some kind of way, people that actually like to get back into agriculture or just farming. Those are the type of people that we basically look at,
mm-hmm.
You know. It's been a lot of talk about the Tidewater Farms and what we had designed or had in mind. It's really what we call an international peace garden. And a guy named Jim Hanna, he's a food guru around here. He writes grants and he kind of see two programs actually moving from one stage to the other. He came out and looked at the program initially and said, that was be one of the names that we should consider, international mm-hmm. peace guy. So it gives us a opportunity to talk about racism, sexism, a lot of the things that oppress our society and things like mm-hmm. that. And actual Crystal, she's going to be on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's one of the individuals that has been working closely with us around trying to set up some of these meetings. It's been extremely difficult to have some meeting around race, because that's a pretty heavy topic. But once you start talking about agriculture, I think it rises above those racial issues, especially today when most of us is concerned about the food that we eat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you were talking about how, you know, refugees or, you know, veterans and sort of this post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
And I know I feel like gardening is sort of a therapeutic kind of process. And have you seen it change people's, you know?
No, I haven't seen it change people's lives. I know what it have done for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I can speak about myself. I have heard other people say how it has been therapeutic for them, but I'm also getting from doctors and therapists that this is something they may even prescribe mm-hmm. for veterans coming home to go back to the land, begin to heal the land, and then they can begin to heal themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I think... is that it's definitely good for the youth. It keeps them out of trouble. I know I started 3 years back, and a bunch of my friends were getting into trouble. It kind of, you know, just made me stay busy and want to learn. So that's what I did, you know, and I thought it was therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice being out there, you know, making your own food and being mm-hmm. successful.
So, like, talk more about, like, so what are the things that you do, like, just, like, kind of walk us through maybe, like, a day.
Well, day starts early, maybe at, like, 6 o'clock in the morning, 'cause it's cooler. Normally we would, you know, at the beginning of the year we plant seedlings and stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, do maintenance, you know, weeds, you know, take care of those things, you know, take all the rocks away, just make it look clean, you know,
because
mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. how stuff grows best.
Yes.
So just basically doing that and, you know, cutting the grass, it's really easy work.
Yeah, if you're working like every little bit every day.
Just taking your time.
Mm-hmm.
Seems nice.
It's not hard at all.
Here's one of the things that happened, and I could give you a rundown on the beginning of how the program basically got mm-hmm. started. We were working with some young folks out in Riverton, okay? And it was about 15, and we had got some grant money from the Goodwill, mm-hmm. a Goodwill industry, part of a jobs creation program or something like that. And we started working with these young guys and girls from Riverton and got a program started that we thought was going to be able to last through a job training program of some sort. The funding didn't come through, so you had to do other things to try to maintain and create other programs. The next year, we only had enough funding for maybe 5 kids. The next year, dwindled down to maybe 3 or 2. And so now what's happening is we're beginning to get a little bit more support from organizations such as NIFI, which is the National Immigrant Farming Initiative, which is coming in, looking at our organization and seeing that it needs some structural repair, you know, it needs help, infrastructure, and it needs to come in and fund it. Anytime you get ready to do a program with youth, one of the things that youth like to do is they like to get paid. You know, they want to earn some money. So you have to put things in place that's going to stabilize a youth program.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we're basically doing with Kaylee is saying, okay, let's use her as a model of what it really takes for a young person to live on their own, number one, that's going to school, that's taking care of their own rent, their books, their food, those things, and really budget that out and see what it would take for a young person to earn that kind of money either over the period of a summer, you know, to go to school,
mm-hmm.
or a period over the summer and work while they go to school. So this is basically what it's about. It's trying to establish a livable income for young people to either engage in the future growing of food that's going to take place here in this state
mm-hmm.
and be a part of that new money, because that's what it basically is, new income, and figure out how to could you go to school and improve on your life as you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kaylee, since, you know, you're in school right now, has, you know, being a part of this program sort of influenced what you're thinking for your future as far as jobs?
Well, first, you know, we work with agriculture, so I thought at school, you know, I'd major in that. But then, you know, as I started to take some of the classes, I realized that what I do better is kind of like a side job. And that's what I do right now is landscaping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I decided to go into horticultural business because, you know, it's all in the same thing. It's all, you know, outdoors, and that's what I love. And I'm just a little bit better at landscaping.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
And so, so would you say that, like, the skills that you acquired from this, you know, like, being a part of this, like, has been, like, applied to other parts of your life?
Actually, every single thing that I've learned from working for the Center for African Heritage, I've applied to my life. Nice. Every single thing, whether it's, you know, just paying a bill or something, like, weird stuff, you know? It's mm-hmm. just helped me, you know, grow up a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we're going to just put a pause on this conversation right now because we do have our other guest, Jessie Doling, who's, again, she's the grassroots organizer for the Right to Know GMO labeling campaign, which is a part of MOFCA.
And I would like to remind everyone what MOFCA is, if you don't know. It's Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association.
Right. So we're just going to be talking to her now.
Hello, Jessie. Can you hear us? Hello?
Jessie, are you there?
All right. So, a little technical difficulties.
Maybe third time
again
will be the charm.
You know, yeah, third time's
charm. All right, so back to talking about the Tidewater Project with you guys. I just wanted to remind you, we are talking to Daoud, Uma, and Kaylee Taylor, who are from the Tidewater Farm Project, which is part of the Center for African Heritage.
Okay, let me clear that up.
Sorry.
Okay. No, I mean, because it happens like that. Okay, but the Tidewater Farms, right? It's a combination of about four organizations, maybe mm-hmm. possibly five. You have the County Extension, they're out there. The SMCC, mm-hmm. they're there. Cultivating Community,
mm-hmm.
Center for African Heritage, and then there's the Tidewater Foundation. And they're all there. And I think the original vision was to have a learning center that was there, and I think you have with SMCC and the County Extension, you have those organizations there to serve as teaching facilities, mm-hmm. and then you have Cultivating Community and the Center for African Heritage as learning facilities for the community to mm-hmm. come out and begin to participate, and if you have any questions, you could easily go over to the learning facilities and learn about what's happening on the ground. So that was the original idea. Funding became an issue, so they kind of backed off of it. And so right now it's just the Center for African Heritage, the same groups, but we're trying to reorganize
okay.
and figure out how we could have a sustainable program where young people, for example, we have a program out at Lyman Moore Middle School starting out there. They could take their project and move out there on a piece of property that's a little bit larger than a greenhouse and start to moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
That was the ideal. And that's what we began to try to implement. And you can see it follow through from Lyman Moore all the way up to Orno. And these are the things that we're trying to connect.
Okay. And I just want to remind you that this is a call-in show. The number is 780-4909. Again, that's 780-4909. So call in with any questions or comments. All right, so we're going to try to
again, we're going to be talking to Jessie Dowling from MOFCA Grassroots Organization for the Right to Know GMO Labeling Campaign. Hello, Jessie. Are you on the line?
Hello. Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Finally. Awesome. Your guys are a little quiet on your end, but thanks for having me on your show tonight. Love
thanks
to talk
for being
to you a little
here.
Bit about our organizing on engineered foods and getting them labeled here in Maine.
Mm-hmm. First, you know, why should we as citizens be concerned about this, about, you know, labeling of genetically modified foods?
Well, right. Well, Genetically modified foods are different from regular seeds or different crops. The majority of them are soy, corn, cotton, canola, and sugar beets. Some papaya, sweet corn, a little bit of summer squash. And the difference is these are being inserted into that wouldn't naturally exist. They're happening artificially in a laboratory. And the new technology has
Sorry to interrupt you, Jesse. We're having some, having some connecting issues, maybe.
Yeah, you're breaking up a lot.
So let's see what we can do.
Can you hear me better on this phone?
Oh, yes, that's much better.
Okay, great. I couldn't tell before if it was my phone or your phone, but what did you hear last?
So how about if you could just redo that whole thing for us?
Sorry about that.
It's all right. So why should we be concerned about genetically modified foods?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that people really need to know about genetically engineered foods, number one, is that the scientific testing has not been done. It's not out there. The science has been done mostly by the companies that make the seeds, which are Monsanto and other large agribusinesses. And what genetically engineering is when you insert a gene into a plant, like soy, cotton, canola, sugar beets, that wouldn't happen through natural selection. It would be a gene that came from another organism, such as a bacteria, such as the BT corn and canola, and that gene would allow that plant, when you would spray a pesticide on it, for it to not die. So not only are you getting food that has some genetic altering, you're also getting food that's being heavily applied by pesticides directly, because they will not die when you put pesticides on them. So the LD 718, an act to protect Maine food consumers and right to know, is a labeling campaign that we're doing in the state. We're trying to get GMOs labeled at the state level, and we're having pretty good success in getting our legislators on board with it.
Great. Actually, that was my next question. I was wondering how legislators would react to this bill.
Well, we actually have a lot of support in the legislature. It's a bipartisan bill. It was sponsored by Lance Harvell, a Republican out of Farmington, and there were 123 co-sponsors on the bill. And right now, this week, is as early as Thursday, there could be a vote on this bill. And so it's a really important time for people who care about getting GMOs labeled to contact their legislators. And it's not the state, like national legislators, like Collins or Pingree. It's the local one, like in Portland area, maybe Ann Haskell is one of the senators, for example. But you can look online and find out who your senator is. But those are the people, the senators and the House of Representatives in Augusta, are going to be voting on this legislation. And we could be one of the first states in the whole country to allow labeling, or to require labeling of genetically modified foods.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard that the GMO industries are arguing that we're facing a food shortage and that GMOs are the best solution. What do you say to that?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that people have a lot of concern about allergies and a lot of concerns about what the effects of pesticide use on plants are in our food. And without labeling, we can't even do the studies to find out if genetically engineered foods can make a difference. And I'd like to argue, as a farmer who uses organic practices myself, that I don't buy that, you know, heavily oil-intensive, pesticide-intensive, you know, patented seed-intensive agriculture is feeding the world. I'd argue that it's not.
Mm. And
why do you, well, I'm trying to think of the
right
thing.
Had something right there.
Me too.
So you were saying, the labeling is good to find out allergies and, to be able to run these tests. So, why is the GMO industry sort of against this bill, and like, what do they have to lose by labeling products?
I think that's a great question, and I think you got to look to the larger global population to find out why. 63 countries already require labeling of GMOs. GMOs aren't popular in other countries. There have been countries that have refused food aid from the U.S. because they didn't want their GMO corn. And just recently, there has been a case of unapproved by the FDA, unregulated GMO wheat being found in fields in Oregon. And actually, South Korea and Japan have barred imports from the U.S. because of it. So I think there's a global concern about the use of genetically engineered foods, and the U.S. is kind of lagging behind in kind of that whole debate.
Mm-hmm. So are there studies in other countries then that show that GMO products might be dangerous? On what basis do you know did they ban them?
There are some studies, but I don't think that there have been enough peer-reviewed scientific data to really do the whole issue justice. And the main reason is because if they're not labeled, you don't know which ones they are. Mm-hmm. So I think the first step is to, you know, give us a label, give the people of Maine a right to know what's in their food, and then we can start to see, okay, well, are people being allergic to certain brands? Oh, are those brands using GMO soy? Maybe it's the genetically modified, or maybe it's glyphosate, which is a Roundup Ready pesticide that all of these plants that are under that specific gene technology engineered so that you can spray it with glyphosate and not kill the plant. So therefore, you're ingesting, you know, some trace residue of that.
Mm-hmm. And so, Jesse, you were talking about how there's going to be, you know, a lot of action taking place this Thursday. And if you could just say that again for, to say this again to any of our listeners that want to get involved.
Yeah, actually, it's really critical moment for folks to get involved. If you haven't already contacted your representative and your senator on the local level, it's really important that you do so because they're going into a vote as early as by the end of this week. I don't know what day, but it's going to happen soon. So get your calls in as soon as you can. You can call, write a letter, email. But it really will make a difference because these folks that we've elected in Augusta, they represent you. And if you let them know that this is important to you, there's a chance that we could win this bill and make a huge advance in what we know is in our food. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that we don't know what we're eating.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you for, you know, educating us on this issue you know, just taking time out of your day to be with us. So again, Jesse, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So, again, listeners, that was Jesse Dowling, who's the grassroots organizer for the Right to Know GMO, Genetically Modified Foods Labeling Campaign. So thank you for having her. So now we're back with Daoud Uma and Kaylee Taylor from the Center of African Heritage. So with your, like, farming techniques, since we were just talking about genetically modified plants and seeds, you know, how is that, you know, like, what is, what is your, you know, what kind of seeds do you use, and
or
are you aware
of
this issue?
Gardening practices in general are you supporting?
We're looking at the organic, or natural, methods, okay, because we know about all the, genetically modified products that we want to stay away from. But we also have to educate the growers. Okay, we have to work with one another to get on the same page. Because if this is something that's a global issue and it's in a crisis, because this is some of the terms that they like to use is crisis and things of that nature, then I think it would be more interesting to invite young people to a crisis instead of just farming, and let them know that you're participating in something for our future, number one. There's a future in it for cleaning up and fixing up the mess that's been made, and it pays pretty well. And so if you was to look at it in those terms, say you clean up your own food, you clean up the mess that's been made here, you're preparing for jobs for the future, I think it may have a different appeal, but just to say that it's a cool thing and that we're into organic farming and this, that, the other, and you know, it seems pretty exclusive. No, because there's a lot of people in and around this particular area, especially Portland, that have come from farm backgrounds. And if we're in a crisis, and that's what has been declared, you got plenty of hands out there ready to go to work. So there's a negotiation that has to take place on how do you address that particular crisis. Do you address it with organic food only that's outside of the reach of the average poor person? Because it is. Or do you say we make some adjustments in our technique where it may be natural with organic methods and say that's where we want to stay? Because anything else, we can't afford organic. Mm-hmm. And this is the truth of the matter. We can't afford organic. We can't go to a Whole Food and expect to service our whole family. So there have to be some kind of way that we begin to negotiate these terms for good food for some and unaffordable food for others.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell me?
And Kaylee, you know, like being a part of this, how has it like shaped you and your thoughts for the future as far as like making a change, like trying to gear away from using like genetically modified seeds or like plants?
Well, I think all natural is great. My sister, you know, buys only all natural food from the grocery store. So like with these genetically modified foods, I don't really back them up because I feel as though they might, you know, harm me in some way. I don't know that. I've never really thought of it. I mean, besides that,
mm-hmm.
I'm more of an all-natural person.
I don't know. It looks
like we're heading into
we have to
our break soon, but I'm thinking
we have a minute to go.
We have a minute to go. I'm trying to. Sorry.
Okay. I know. Like, what do we have time left for?
Yes.
Well, I guess.
Trying to think of a good question to go with that.
And now we're just like
just treading
time.
Water.
Is there actually, because we are wrapping up with this, is there anything else you'd like to say about the Tidewater project? Listeners that want to
get involved with this kind of thing, or
right now, we have most of our plots filled up. We're taking applications. They're online. I think it's CFAH.me. And you should see an online application. We haven't been getting a good response from that, so we have to do hand soliciting and going out and seeing people like mm-hmm. that. And try to make sure that you get a good connection and a good group and try to plan better for next year and so that we could have a better planting season and involvement. But right now we have a couple of things that's happening.
Okay, and also, since we were talking about this in our introduction about how the percentage of Mainers that use or that eat food from Maine is like 10-14%. You know, what do you think, what are your thoughts on this?
That means that there's 85% growth rate there. That mm-hmm. if you're only producing anywhere between 10-15%, that means there's at least an 85% growth rate. That's a lot of growth rate. That means there's plenty of jobs, plenty of opportunities for everybody. This is a thing where Caucasian kids could get involved. Yeah, they getting there. Africans, Asians, Hispanic, adults, handicaps, whatever. Everybody could actually get involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's plenty of room for us to grow because in and around this Cumberland County area, there's plenty of farmland. And it's needed inside the schools. The pantries need it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we was to get on the horn a little bit more and invite people to be a part of that 85%, being a part of that versus this 10% that's buying less food, we could start producing our food. And I think that is the ideal, is for young people to really get caught into this and say, Maine doesn't produce enough food to feed itself.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So we're going to be heading into break now. Thank you very much for being on the show. Kaylee Taylor and Duad. I'm sorry.
I'm Iris San Giovanni.
And I'm Olivia Bradstreet. And you're listening to Blunt Youth Radio. Here's our break.
Tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms before 1 a.m., then a slight chance of showers between 1 and 3 a.m., partly cloudy with a low around 52, southwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour becoming northwest after midnight. Chance of precipitation is 50%, new rainfall amounts of less than a tenth of an inch, except higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. Sunny with a high near 69, northwest wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tuesday night, mostly clear with a low around 46, west wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday, sunny with a high near 69, northwest wind around 5 miles per hour becoming southwest in the afternoon. Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a low around 50, south wind around 5 miles per hour becoming calm after midnight. This is WMPG in W281AC, Gorham, Portland.
Grandfather about small farming in Maine. I'm here talking today with my grandfather, John A. Bradstreet.
A horse and probably three cows and I don't know how many chickens, 30 maybe chickens and probably a dozen sheep. And we had vegetable gardens.
Oh, that depends on your death.
All right. You're listening to Blunt Youth Radio. It's a youth-run public affairs call-in talk show.
And tonight we're talking about agriculture in Maine. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Iris San Giovanni.
With us here,
we have Crystal Gamet, who is the food stamps coordinator for the Portland Farmers Market. We are so glad to have you with us.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Before we get started, I just want to remind our listeners, our number is 780-4909. Again, that's 780-4909. So call in with any questions or comments.
And we'd love to hear from you, especially if you are involved with the local food movement.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And also, we want to promote our new blog, website, Blunt Radio.
It's bluntradio@.org. Bluntradio.org.
.org. So be sure to check that with all our current shows and past shows.
Yes.
All right, now to the nitty-gritty stuff that we want to be talking about. Food stamps. The food stamps program, like, how does it work? Because I was thinking about it, and you can probably clarify, but I was thinking, are the farmers getting instant money? Like, how does this whole process work? So if you could walk us through.
I'd love to. It's really easy. I actually walk people through it every time they come to the table, especially if I can tell that they're new, so I'm used to it already. It's pretty easy. You can come to the information booth at the Farmers Market, at the Wednesday Market in Monument Square, or at the Deering Oaks Market. And you can swipe debit, credit, or food stamps. And there are tokens. They look almost exactly the same for debit and credit and food stamps. They're slightly different in coloration, and that's it. So you get whatever amount you want to use for shopping at the market, and they don't expire. Mm-hmm. So people can get, we'll say, $40 and use it at a variety of different markets, like at a variety of different vendors. And over 90% of the vendors at the market actually accept them. So it's pretty easy to find a vendor that will accept the tokens. It's harder to find a vendor that won't.
Mm-hmm.
So for people, they use it just like money. They all joke about how it's like, oh, it's like real money. It's wooden tokens.
Mm-hmm.
But they give the farmers the tokens in the amount that they are purchasing their products. And then the farmers at the end of the market hand me a bag full of tokens. And then I spend a couple hours counting tokens, and then the farmers get a check, maybe like a week or two later.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how it works. It's pretty simple.
Wow. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so do you feel like this is an effective way to, you know, make fruits and vegetables more, you know, accessible to, you know, the everyday person?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think that, as a customer of the farmers market and also now in this position, sort of managing the food stamp table, I've seen people who have like very emotional responses to finding out they can use their food stamps at the market. It really makes a difference. They say, wow, I can actually buy local food or have a chance to shop at the market that I didn't have before, you know, and it's really increasing accessibility a lot for people.
Especially when organic or just fruits and vegetables in general, or if you even want to get organic, is extremely expensive in a grocery store generally.
Yeah, and it's nice at the market because there's a variety of options.
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many vendors, and some of them are organic and some of them are not organic.
Yeah.
But the best part, or one of the best parts, I think, is that you're usually meeting the farmer, and if not, mm-hmm. you're meeting someone like one time removed, you know, from the farmer. Mm-hmm. So you have that direct connection, and you can ask those questions. Maybe they're not certified organic, but you can say, what do you use?
Mm-hmm.
How do you produce these vegetables or this meat or this mm-hmm. tempeh that I'm purchasing? And then make your choice based on what the farmer tells you. Whereas if you go to the market, you're just reading the package and hoping that it gives you all the information that you're wanting, you know.
And is there, like, an outreach, like, marketing that you're doing to let people know that they can use food stamps at farmers markets?
That's a great question. I just got this job 2 weeks ago. I'm really, really excited about it. Thank
Congratulations.
You. Thanks. And it's sort of a new position. The food stamp program has been at the market for a long time. But There have been a number of people who've sort of taken charge of doing it. So with this new position in place, with me doing it, that's a big piece of what I want to do. And definitely contact me if you have ideas. Or, you know, a local high school, actually, Casco Bay High School, made up some flyers maybe last year. And I'm looking into seeing if they can still be used or something like that. And I'm actually meeting with another high schooler next week. To talk about a brochure that she's working on, and I'm really into using what's already being produced in the community, and especially with young people.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, as aside from making like brochures, how else can sort of the youth get involved with this?
Sure. Well, we are looking for volunteers, which is a great way to get involved. It's really fun. You can come to the market, and I don't know if you've ever been to the Common Ground Fair, but
yes.
They're sort of like known for their volunteers. You always get like a cool volunteer shirt at the at the Common Ground Fair, so it's sort of fun. But I want to do a similar thing and have people sort of guiding parking in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Parking is an issue, and that would be super helpful to get young people involved in that way. And there's other ways that young people can be involved in the market. And if you have ideas, like if people have ideas for ways that they would want to be, I could definitely help make that happen.
That's great.
That's for
great.
Sure.
And so as far as farmers markets, you said there's one in Monument Square, and then there's also the one in
Daring Oaks. And that's in the summer. And then in the winter, there's actually a winter market as well. And the winter one last year was in the Irish Heritage Center, and it will maybe be there again this year.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of still being decided.
Great. And so, oh, that's awesome that this can be a year-round thing, because I was wondering, like, you know, like how, you know, this, how long this like process could happen. And
that's true. And I love the winter market. It's one of the things that's nice about the farmers market is that it's not only about buying food, it's a community space. It's a really social time for most people. The winter one is indoor, so it's sort of intimate in a different way. There's a stage, there's often music.
Mm-hmm.
You can go buy a cup of coffee in the back.
Yeah.
People like hang out. There's chairs and tables.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's almost like becomes its own little community of the people who go to the farmers market, right?
Right, and that's one of the reasons why it's so important for me to make it more accessible to the whole community.
Mm-hmm. Because you're thinking like it's a great like cultural sort of event. So I think it's good that you are working to make it more accessible.
And just that everybody can have that experience of knowing their producer, the consumers can know all the producers.
Mm-hmm. And as far as, I mean, we had this statistic earlier, we were talking about it, how, you know, 10 to 14% of Mainers eat food that comes from Maine. So like, I think, I mean, this is a great way to work towards increasing that percentage.
Definitely. I think there's a lot of momentum too. I think that people, especially in Portland, but all around Maine, there seems to be an energy around that, and people are excited about eating locally grown food and supporting the local economy too, as well.
Mm-hmm. And, do you happen to have, you know, like some sense of what like percentage, farmers' income is like from food stamps?
Mm-hmm.
So are you asking me, sorry, can you say that?
Yeah,
so like
yeah.
What percentage of
how does the money work, basically?
Well, like, yeah, like how much of a percentage of the farmer's income comes from food stamps?
That's a great question. I don't know that exact number. I'm going to get that number. That seems really important to know. But one thing I do know is that the food stamp program in Portland is used more than almost any other market in the country. I think that this is right, but maybe it's not. But I've heard that it's like the second in the country for how many people who are using food stamps use their food stamps. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but check back in with
that's
me.
That's great.
Come visit me at the market and I'll...
Yeah. I know. I have to say, like, I don't go regularly, but the couple times that I have been, like, it is really great and welcoming. Actually, I did a Vox Pop feature for talking to farmers about how dependent they were on oil and the like, production of their food, which was interesting. we're going to take a moment to...
And if you'd like to comment on this piece, that would be great. So I sat down with my grandfather. He grew up in rural Maine in Palermo on a family farm. And he's 80 years old. And I sat down and talked to him about food production in Maine during the Depression and during his childhood. So here's the piece.
I decided to interview my grandfather about small farming in Maine.
I'm here talking today with my grandfather, John A. Bradstreet. So you were born on the family land in 1933, and you grew up here in rural Palermo, Maine, on a small farm. Can you tell me a little bit about what the sort of things you grew or the animals you had?
We had a pig. We had a horse. And probably three cows, and I don't know how many chickens, 30 maybe chickens, and probably a dozen sheep. And we had vegetable gardens. We grew all our own vegetables, potatoes, green beans, peas, beets, carrots, all that sort of stuff.
What are your thoughts on organic farming versus using pesticides?
I think we were all organic, but we never heard the word before.
Produced or the surrounding farms.
Well, they didn't have any money to buy food, so they had to raise it. Otherwise, well, there were surplus commodities, and I can remember when they got rice one time, and they had, three or four cans of rice upstairs in the shed. My mother used to use that. Other than that, I don't think there was anything. We butchered our own sheep and cows. We had no refrigeration. Oh, yeah. Well, they made their own butter, too. Churn butter. I can remember my mother putting pans of cream on shelves in Sullivan. It was the coolest place in the house, and the cream would rise, and she'd skim the cream off and make butter.
Now, we were just having a discussion over dinner this evening about the fact that many families in Maine are now having to go to food shelters to get food to support their families. And I know you were just saying because it was during the Depression, you had to be growing a lot of your own food because there was no money. Do you think that people should be growing more of their own food now?
Certainly should. They could save a lot of money. But no, they'd have to buy everything. Go walk around the supermarket and look for sale in the supermarket. It's just overwhelming. They have so much food there.
How do you think food production has changed throughout your life in Maine?
Food production? During my life, it's gone from small family farms to mega farms where they raise tons of vegetables instead of just a few.
What do you think about people who do not have the ability to grow their own food or they don't have their own land? How do you think they could support themselves with local food in Maine?
There are people that can rent land from other people. Other people, and there is people that will let them have a piece of land for free just to raise their own vegetables. But they have to get out there and dig it up themselves, plant it themselves and all that.
Now, you were saying that you have to have mega farms to be successful. Why do you think that is now?
Because a small farmer can't get money enough from a small plots of land. They have to have many, many acres of land. Dairy farmers have to have 1,000 cows before they can even begin to break even. That's a lot of work, 1,000 cows.
Now, what are your thoughts on the current movement to get back to small farming?
Movement to get back to small farming? There's quite a few of them now. Whether they actually can make a living at it, that's a good question.
Do you think it is important or good?
Important or good, yeah. Get back to land.
Reporting for Blunt Youth Radio, this is Olivia Bradstreet.
So we're back on the air.
Thank you, Olivia, for that piece. Your grandfather's interesting man.
He is a very interesting person. And I just want to remind our listeners, after that little silence from us, that this is Blunt Youth Radio, and we're discussing agriculture in Maine. And we just listened to a piece where I interviewed my grandfather, and he made some points that I agree with and other points that I think I disagree with. Like, obviously people with smaller farms are making money. They're selling at the local farmers markets. They aren't totally penniless, but I think it's probably a certain type of lifestyle you have to set up to be successful with a small farm.
And I was thinking, well, I mean, there's many things I was thinking while listening to the piece. And maybe, Crystal, you can sort of comment on what I have to say. But as far as, like, I just feel like it makes so much, the cycle of food stamps being used at the farmer's market, like, because, like, you're supporting, you know, like, the residents of Maine by, you know, giving them food stamps, but then you're supporting local farmers in Maine. Like, it's a cycle, and it just it makes
and
so
I'll
much sense.
And I'll obviously have to remind him that you can use your food stamps at a farmer's market, because his point, he had a lot of points about how you could only find the crap in the stores or whatever, but
He reminded me to say something, though. I thought it was amazing. It's so cool that you got to do that with your grandfather. That's really special. But you can use your food stamps. You should tell your grandfather this.
Yes.
You can use your food stamps to buy seedlings so that you can grow your own gardens.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that we're really promoting right now.
Yes.
If you come to the information booth, I put flyers all over the place because it's the time to buy seedlings. Every vendor has beautiful seedlings, or not every vendor, but a lot of them. And you can use your food stamps. And so instead of using your food stamps to buy one tomato, you can buy a plant and grow many tomatoes.
Ah, that's exciting. It makes me happy to hear that all of this, like, this movement is taking place.
So we're going to be talking to someone now. We'll have them on the line who can tell you what to do with those seedlings you can get at the farmer's market. We have Joe Dupree on the line. He's from MOFCA. He coordinates, like, MOFCA Landscape Coordinator, and is in charge of logistics for Farm and Homestead Day, which we will be discussing with him. So, hi, Joe. Can you hear us?
Hi. Hi there.
Thanks for being on the show.
Sure. So I'm going to let you lead me here. What would you like me to talk about?
Well, we were, would you tell us a little bit about Farm and Homestead Day, you know, what it is and what you can do there?
Okay, and I'll just let you know from my end, you're breaking up considerably, so I hope people can hear me. Years ago, MOFCA used to have an event called Small Farm Field Day, and this is a revival of that. And our idea here, this is a volunteer-driven event. I'm almost the only MOFCA staff that's involved with this, but we have a planning committee, and we had people that will be coming in to help us set up and run the event of the day and then take down the day after. We have a series of classes that we're going to be putting on that are hands-on and participatory. So you come to these sessions. I mean, you certainly can take notes and you'll learn things, but what we're hoping to do mostly is to learn by doing. So, for example, we've got somebody coming with a draft horse who will be talking about what to look for if you want to buy a draft horse, but also he'll be running a session where you would get to put a harness on a draft horse. And then later on he would be doing a session on how to drive a horse, basically how to use the reins to guide the horse, and we'd be doing that in our showroom. And we've got, I'm looking at a schedule here, we've got almost 60 different sessions like this on things like fiber arts. We've got spinning, hand spinning, drop spinning. Somebody's going to be showing how to do some weaving. We've got a woman there that will be having people help her make sheets of felt to build a yurt. We've got some folks that are doing sessions on building livestock fencing out of found materials.
That sounds awesome, Joe. Could you just tell our listeners where, you know, basic information about Farm and Homestead Day, how they can go, you know, what time it is,
sure.
Where it is?
Farm and Homestead Day is going to be at the Common Ground Fairgrounds at MOFCA's Education Center in Unity. That's on Crosby Brook Road. We're holding it on Saturday, June 15th. At 7 in the morning, for people that are interested in learning how to mow grass with scythes, Scythe Supply will be there with equipment to help people learn how to do scything. And then all the regular sessions will start at 9. It's a rain or shine event, so whether it's raining or sunny, we're going to hold the event, so you would need to dress appropriately for the day. It is a much lower key event than, say, Common Ground Fair, so we won't have any food vendors there, so people should expect to pack a lunch. And classes will run until 3.
Great. Thank you very much for being on the air. I'm excited to go personally, but...
We're always looking for volunteers, too, and people are interested in coming up for Saturday and hanging out overnight. We'll have camping available, and people can help us take the tents down and everything on Sunday morning.
Very cool. All right. Thank you very much for being on the air.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye. Thanks for having us.
All right. So that was Joe Dupree. And in studio with us right now is Crystal Gamet. You know, we're about to wrap up the